Today is the one-year anniversary of President Barack Obama's inauguration, and what a difference a year makes. The president currently has one of the lowest approval ratings of any president after 1 year in office. And with the surprise win of a Republican in a special Senate election in Massachusetts, the Democrats no longer have a veto-proof majority in the Senate. This is Politics Day on Talk of Iowa. I'm Jonathan All in for Greg Shanley. Today's Stefan Schmidt, political science professor at Iowa State University, and New Hampshire political analyst Arnie Arneson will join us to talk about the past year and what's coming up in politics. We also want to hear from you, your calls and emails on today's program. It's Politics Day on Talk of Iowa here on Iowa Public Radio. First, this check of news. This is Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Jonathan All, in for Greg Shanley. A little-known state representative in the Massachusetts legislature is now going to be that state's newest U.S. senator. And it's sending political shockwaves through Washington, D.C. and the rest of the nation on the one-year anniversary of Barack Obama's inauguration. Joining us on this Politics Day to talk about this and many other issues, looking back and forward, Stefan Schmidt, political science professor at Iowa State University. Stefan, good morning.
Good morning.
And Arnie Arneson, New Hampshire-based political analyst. Arnie, welcome to the show.
Yeah, in the shadow of the Massachusetts implosion.
Well, I was going to start with you.
Yes, depending on how you look at it.
I was going to start with you, Arnie. You have a ringside seat to Massachusetts politics, being right next door there in New Hampshire. This didn't get a lot of national attention until a few days ago. So what was the mood out east on this? I think it's still safe to call it an upset win.
Well, let me tell you that I would say three-quarters of the activists in New Hampshire, be they Republican or Democrat, were living in the state of Massachusetts for the weekend because everyone and their uncle was calling people and bringing people out because no one thought that the Kennedy seat would be anything but a safe seat for Democrats. And the sad thing is that in the state of Massachusetts, to be honest with you, nothing is as safe as you assume, because while Massachusetts always goes down on the blue register because of people like Kennedy and Kerry, when it comes to electing governors, the other statewide elected office, it has gone Republican consistently for years. So you know, if nothing else, Massachusetts voters are kind of quirky, and they're not necessarily predictable. And I think the message of this campaign is not just that Coakley was not an enthusiastic, exciting, passionate, articulate candidate. It's that you can never assume in a democracy that the seat is yours, or that the buyer, in this case, the electorate, buys into the concept of it's your turn. Let me remind everyone who's ever thinking of running for office, there is no such thing as it's your turn. And I think that that's part of the problem. So as much as you're going to hear a lot of Democrats complaining about what a terrible race Coakley ran, she didn't run an exciting race, but everyone and every Democrat assumed she'd win no matter what kind of race she ran, no matter what.
So
and that was the wrong assumption.
Stefan, do you think that did the Democrats lose this race, or did the Republicans win it?
Well, I'll tell you, I also have a ringside seat because I spent a lot of time in Massachusetts. I have a lot of family there. I spent a lot of time in New Hampshire. I have a lot of relatives who constantly contact me. And there are two things. One, when Ted Kennedy died, no one could replace him. Ted Kennedy was the big dig. He was the guy who brought massive amounts of pork to Massachusetts, probably the largest public works project in recent history in the United States. And once he was gone, people did not think that, you know, a replacement of Kennedy would ever be able to do that magic, because he was the lion of the Senate. And, you know, so they were, you know, the history had passed them. The second thing is, the Kennedy clan actually isn't really very popular in Massachusetts. And this is a very well-kept secret that I want to reveal now. They are arrogant. The caterers on Cape Cod who catered Kennedy events, most of them refused to do it because the Kennedys assumed that if you were invited to cater to their event, you know, you could send them a bill and stuff, but it was the honor of catering to the Kennedys that was really your compensation. And there are a lot of people who really are angry at the Kennedys. And so nobody talks about it out of respect for the deceased and so on. But I think those two factors basically made it a really open race, especially in a state
and
where, in fact, the Democrats are not the majority.
But here's the other thing. The Democrats and the Republicans didn't win. A guy who flashed his pickup truck, who never mentioned the word Republican, talked about its Massachusetts seat. It's our seat. It's the seat for the independent voter, for the independent thinker. He didn't even mention party. He didn't even mention party because party has a bad taste in everyone's mouth. That's the problem, Jonathan. So what happened was a guy who appears to be anti-establishment, who, you know, I was just on Al Jazeera this morning. And I was on Al Jazeera, and the woman that I was on with was from Washington, D.C. She was a political analyst. She said, yeah, isn't it amazing? This brilliant lawyer, Attorney General Martha Coakley, lost to some guy who didn't even have a college education. And I went, excuse me, honey, Scott Brown went to law school. He's a practicing lawyer. The fact that he packaged like he was a high school graduate doesn't mean that that's who he is, but that was the appeal that was working. If it didn't smell like Washington, if it didn't sound like an elite, if it played the populist card, if it ran against the intransigence in Washington, it was going to work because people are fed up. It wasn't a party that won. It was disgust that won.
Okay, was it an ideology that won? Because it seems like the rhetoric has been, it was very clear that Mr. Brown was going to go to Washington with the intent of doing everything he could to stop the health care overhaul bill,
to
stop cap and trade.
But Jonathan, this is the one he voted
well, but
for
the Massachusetts,
in Massachusetts
one, but it's a lot
Romney
different,
voted.
Right?
No,
but,
it's not a lot different. And ironically, it's almost identical, except here's the sad story of the Massachusetts healthcare model. And the story is that the Massachusetts healthcare model was not only almost identical to the national one, but if the national one passed, Massachusetts would then be obligated to send additional money to other states who had not embraced a similar concept. So isn't it bizarre that it would turn out to hurt Massachusetts to have done the quote-unquote maybe right thing? And that was the other underpinning here, was that even though people were talking about the health care reform and it was a bad thing, believe it or not, passing it would have hurt Massachusetts financially. That was voting against their own self-interest if they embraced Martha Coakley.
Well, then, does the system work then? Because if Massachusetts voters looked at the national health care overhaul and saw that it was worse for them in a representative democracy, they elected someone to office that they believe would stop that.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Exactly. Amen.
And I agree that, in fact, what it is this populist, it's not the Tea Party, because the Tea Party, you know, is just one phenomenon. But it is a lot of people who really are concerned and angry about government getting too big. Even about my students asked me in class, why do we need to provide a lot of American taxpayer money in Haiti? They said, you know what, there are so many places in the world. They're all in desperate need of something. How much can we really do? We have all these problems here in the United States. We've got all this unemployment, and we have all these issues that we've got a budget deficit. And they asked me those questions very sincerely. And I was taken aback because I'm a believer in humanitarian assistance. But that's the mood that's out there is, you know, the world is a very nasty place with things falling apart and disasters and, you know, political regimes that are unspeakable and people planning to blow up their underwear to kill Americans. And people, I think people are moving into a kind of an isolationist mood, into a kind of mood where they would like to shrink down what we're doing for people. And we're seeing it happen, even if we don't want it. We're seeing it happen, Arnie, because the states themselves, Iowa and other states, have severe budget problems, and we're going to be doing more with less or less with less, as I call it, all over the country. And to see Washington essentially pumping up and inflating the costs of things while we are slashing and cutting and firing people and shrinking the universities and shrinking public health, you know, shutting down homes for delinquent youth, so now they're going to be out on the streets. people just, you know, don't like what they see. And I think
With you that people don't like what they see, but here's what I think. I think people are asking government, what have you done for me? We now see Wall Street getting bailed out. We now see Goldman Sachs claiming the biggest profit in ever, giving out bonuses. We see Washington serving special interests, but not the public interest. And I think that's the problem. The problem is, it isn't that people don't want government to respond to their needs. They don't believe it anymore.
Wait a second.
They serve the other guy's needs, the Wall Street needs, the bankers' needs, the ConAg's needs, but you don't serve them. I mean,
but Arnie, none of this is new. Why now and not 2 years ago, 4 years ago, six years ago, eight years ago?
Because George Bush never said he was going to help you out, but Barack Obama did. Barack Obama said, I'm going to make government different. I'm going to rule differently. I'm going to care about you. I'm going to understand that you need support from me because it's not about Wall Street. It is about Main Street. And then all they saw for the first couple of months was they couldn't move on a dime when it came to health care that was supposed to be about us. In fact, they kept genuflecting to every special interest to try to accommodate them, and they still don't have a bill. Then they watched what happened with the Wall Street bailout, and they were appalled. And then they saw what happened with the mortgages and the foreclosures, and they created all these programs that nobody could access, and they finally said, wait a second, you said things were going to be different, you're not accomplishing anything that touches our lives, and the rich people are getting richer. How is that different?
Well, I think, Arnie, George W. Bush got elected president as a compassionate conservative. He got elected because he fuzzed himself up and said, I really want to do things for people, and compassionate conservatism was what appealed to independents. Then we had terrorism and the war in Afghanistan and the war in Iraq and all of that, and it derailed that, and people, you know, forgot that he had promised that, but they figured, well, he couldn't deliver on that because we were now at war. And so when Obama came and started talking about a unifier, not a partisan, that he wanted to bring in the Republicans, that was post-racial and post-partisan politics, and talked about a lot of ways of healing America and so on. Once again, compassionate democraticism, I guess. I think liked that, and they liked his personality. And once he got elected, they figured out that it is, in fact, powerful interests that dominate the agenda in Washington. And no matter who gets elected, it is those interests. Because, frankly, the Republicans are not going to take on the Wall Street banks and those places either, as far as I can tell. So voting for a Republican is not much of a smart move if you are concerned about those inequities.
And we'll talk about that and more coming up after this quick break. We also would like your phone calls and emails. You can call us at 866-780-9100, 866-780-9100, or you can also send us an email at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. I'm Jonathan All in for Greg Shanley. We'll be back with more of Politics Day in just a moment. This is Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Jonathan All, filling in for Greg Shanley. Stephen Schmidt and Arnie Arneson are here talking about politics on this Politics Wednesday. We're going to start on the phones. John in Des Moines has a comment about health care. John, welcome to the show.
Yeah, hey, it's a good day, isn't it? Hey, well, I think you guys are forgetting, the last time I called in was also a day after an election. And do you think we're seeing a trend here? I kind of think we are. And I think what this is about is the country, and polls are showing this, that the country feels like we're on the wrong track. They see a very left-wing liberal agenda. They do not support it. This is primarily a conservative country. And I think it's going to be a bad year for Democrats.
Well, John, John, just a second. If you believe that this is that the country is predominantly a conservative country, then why did Barack Obama win last year?
He won because it was anything at that point, anything but George Bush and the Republicans. People were mad at the Republicans. But I think people have kind of sobered up and come to their senses, and they see in Obama what a left-wing agenda looks like. If you remember, a year ago on this program, there was discussion about how dead the Republican Party is, how they eat their own, and so on. And Barack Obama has single-handedly revived the conservative movement and the Republican Party. very left-wing agenda.
Tell me how it's a left-wing agenda to throw massive amounts of money at the biggest health insurance companies in this country
right.
as a way of providing health care. I mean, that's not a left-wing agenda. A left-wing agenda is to have national health care. This is
the private sector,
it's the private sector.
Well, but
people perceive this as a first step towards national health care.
No, they don't.
And
you've
had
Medicare.
Democrats say that privately.
Well, but here's the irony, is that what you said is not true. Because one of the tactics that is used against the health care reform package is they're going to harm your Medicare. They're going to hurt your Medicare. Your Medicare, everyone, is socialism for people over the age of 65. And so the way they attack the health care reform is to say they're going to touch your socialism because they want to produce a capitalist answer with insurance companies. I mean, that's the problem. The American people are not that black and white. They're much more nuanced. What they know is they feel vulnerable. They feel economically strapped. They're concerned about whether they're going to go to a doctor when they're sick, and they want someone to help them figure it out.
That is patently untrue, Arnie, and because 85% of people have coverage in this country. So that is not true of the American public at all.
But 85% of the people have coverage. So let's figure out how many of those people have coverage, now have coverage because of Medicare, now have coverage because of Medicaid, now have coverage because they're paying an increasing portion of their remuneration package in their out-of-pocket costs for premiums. People have it, but at some point in time, what you're beginning to realize is it's either eroding in quality for those who have to pay out of their own pocket, or more and more of us are going on a government program.
Not the perception of people that I'm around, and I think the polls show that 85% of people have coverage through their work, and what they're afraid of is a government takeover that's going to cancel their private insurance that they now have, not have as good of insurance, and it's going to raise the price. And there's been a lot of discussion and conflicting figures about the cost of this. It's kind of interesting that they want to bill us now for this and start this coverage down the road.
Well, you're right that people are very confused, and I'm raising my hand right here because I'm confused as to what this is going to do to me. And when you're confused and there's uncertainty and you don't trust the government, which we don't do, you don't want it. You want somebody to come up with something that you can understand, and that's why the Democrats are now talking about going back to something that is more familiar to people, and what they're going back to is saying, well, maybe what we can do is throw out all this stuff and just make more people eligible for Medicare, which is a government-run program, which is kind of weird. The other thing is that, yes, people see the country going in the wrong direction, but the reason the Democrats won, as you pointed out, is because they saw the country going into the really wrong direction with the Republicans, and so they thought they could change. And what they've discovered is that you can switch back and forth between the two parties, but you're really not going to get anything very different, because it's interests that are there that have a headlock on politicians and on government. And those same interests, they'll back a Democrat, they'll back a Republican, they'll back whoever it is that can preserve their particular special interests. And that's,
John, I think, a
sad thing.
Thank you for your call. John, Stefan, Arnie, do you think yesterday's election in Massachusetts was a referendum on health care reform?
Well, I think it was a referendum on big government and on all of the policies that began at the end of the Bush administration with the bailouts of the banks, with throwing a ton of taxpayer money at companies that had badly misbehaved. And then when Obama came in, he simply expanded that because that seemed to be the only solution to bring some kind of tranquility to the banking system. And as Arnie said, people are losing their mortgages, and people with good credit ratings and jobs are now worried about their mortgages. People are having their credit card billing suddenly completely sabotaged by credit card companies who are adding on fees that nobody can understand. People are angry about government getting too big. People are concerned about what this Obamacare is going to do to their health care. People are very alarmed that we don't have a good terrorism interdiction system at all in place, and that when you get on an airplane, you're pretty safe. Most people realize that's why they're still flying, but that there are people out there who'd like to make it less safe. And it's a package of concerns that make people want, I think, to go and look for a different solution.
Arnie, do you think yesterday was a referendum on health care?
Can I tell you why Massachusetts is such a bad place to make that decision? Because it is the place where the model for health care reform is based. I mean, if it had been any other state and people were reacting to the mañana and not yet and all the lies and fictions about health care, I could say it was about the health care reform package. But Massachusetts is the quirkiest place for us to read that message. I know what Scott Brown was running on. I'm going to be the 41st vote against health care reform in a state that has that health care reform that he voted for. So the question then becomes, was it about health care reform generically, or was it all these sort of little pricks that came together with disaffected voters who are so frustrated and angry? And let's be honest with you, Barack Obama has, as our last caller suggested, you know, basically brought in and ushered in all this socialism liberal agenda. Really? What has he seen yet?
Speaking of callers,
the problem is it's fiction right now, but so far nobody has actually experienced the socialist agenda except for Wall Street.
Let's go to Tom in Cedar Rapids. Tom, welcome to Talk of Iowa.
Thank you. First, I want to mention to your guests, I appreciate both of you, and every time I listen to you, I pick up on your sincerity, and I think that's a really precious thing, and I want to thank you for being so candid with everyone on when you share your opinions. I just want to say that I, for one, am a voter who has become completely disenfranchised with the American political system. I confess that I really don't know what's going on in Washington, but my deep suspicions are that, as you said, no matter which party is elected, the agenda is going to be the agenda of special interests and big money groups and peoples. And I'm deeply concerned that I don't know what needs to change or how it needs to change, but if something doesn't change, that the political system could possibly precipitate some kind of a disaster. And I am honestly and deeply and sincerely concerned about the welfare of all the people in this country who I feel completely lack honest, fair, equitable representation in our government.
Steph, Arnie, well, I'm sure you've heard that argument before.
Yeah, I've heard it before, and I want to tell our caller that our job here is, our mission is to raise your blood pressure. So I'm glad we seem to be accomplishing that, because we deal with issues that really are troubling, and we talk about them honestly. We don't sugarcoat them. And what you're saying is very troubling, and it's troubling to me. I mean, it's troubling to me, for example, that the richest, most magnificent state in the United States in terms of resources, which would be California, is dying because the political system is so broken, and the Democrats and Republicans in California are destroying California. And
Stefan, one of the other things, let's go to California, and then let's also look at what's happening in the United States Senate. Because in part, a democracy is predicated on the concept of rule of a majority, except we have now embraced something called the supermajority. In California, to raise taxes, it's a supermajority. In the United States Senate, to pass anything, it's a supermajority. That's not a democracy.
That's not a democracy anymore. We'll talk more about that in just a moment after our environment report. Stefan Schmidt, Arnie Arneson, your phone calls and emails after this break on Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
A new kind of brick hits the wall with industry. This is the Environment Report. I'm Lester Graham. The ash from burning coal is considered waste. Well, a company has started making bricks using coal ash from power plants. This firm says it saves dumping it in the landfills, and not as much energy is needed to make these bricks. Chuck Quernbach has more on that.
The company, CalStar, says it wants to open several U.S. plants which would use fly ash in making bricks for construction and paving. The California firm says its method uses far less energy than traditional clay bricks that have to be heated at high temperatures. Luke Pustovsky is a CalStar executive. He insists the quality of fly ash brick meets industry standards.
We spent 18 months and millions of dollars on durability testing with our own labs, with outside third-party labs, and this is a brick that's built to last.
But a trade group, the Brick Industry Association, is cool to fly ash brick. The group says the product has not yet met the test of time. The group is concerned any problems that come up could discourage customers from using brick. For the Environment Report, I'm Chuck Kornbach.
This is the Environment Report. The U.S. Supreme Court has turned down a request from Michigan and other Great Lakes states. They wanted the locks to a canal to be closed immediately. That man-made canal artificially connects the Mississippi River system and the Great Lakes. For now, at least, those locks will stay open. This is all about a fish, a type of Asian carp that many people don't want to get into the Great Lakes and has already infested the Mississippi River system. David Jude is a research scientist and a fish biologist at the University of Michigan. So what is it that people think this Asian carp fish will do to the Great Lakes?
Well, I'm sure they all watch the video where fish are jumping out of the river in the Illinois River and harming some of the biologists and some of the people that are there.
Smacks them in the head.
Yes, so they're very concerned about that. And then the biologists are concerned about the fact they have taken over the river. They are very voracious feeders, and so they've really crowded out all the other fish in the river. So there's a lot of things that are going on with regard to impacts on humans as well as impacts on fish communities that we certainly don't like.
And these are big fish. They're up to 100 pounds.
Exactly.
All of this seems to be coming down to money. Is money the right measure when we're looking at this situation?
No, it's not. And I mean, traditionally, we've gone into a lot of these decisions are made and the environmental costs are not taken into consideration. Once they get in there, there's going to be a very detrimental impact.
This fish is knocking at the door. We're not even sure it's not already in. So is there a certain inevitability that this fish is going to be in the Great Lakes and we should just start making plans to deal with it?
Well, I don't think it's inevitable. And I think if we did stop them and somehow were able to shut down the Chicago Sanitary Canal and prevent that avenue, we'd be going a long way toward preventing them from coming in. So I think we should do everything we can right now to stop them. I mean, this is our opportunity to do that. But, you know, the other part of it is because they're so close and because, as you noted, there probably could be some in the lakes already, you know, we should be prepared to have some plans on what we might want to do to try to, you know, maybe focus in on some of these optimal spawning sites and see what we could do to keep their populations down there.
David Jude is a research scientist and fish biologist at the University of Michigan. Thanks for coming in.
Oh, my pleasure.
That's the Environment Report. I'm Lester Graham.
Support comes from the Joyce Foundation and the Great Lakes Fishery Trust. You can find more information and post your comments at environmentreport.org. The Environment Report comes from the University of Michigan.
This is Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Jonathan All in for Greg Shanley, Stephen Schmidt, and Arnie Arneson. Are our guests for this Politics Wednesday. We're also taking your phone calls and emails. You can email us at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org or call 866-780-9100. We're talking about yesterday's Senate win in Massachusetts and the ramifications that it has, it may be a symptom of. We're going to go to a couple of callers to start this segment and get their takes on it. We're going to start with John in Des Moines, and I believe this is a different John from Des Moines than we had on earlier. Is that correct, John?
Yeah, I'm a little further to the left than the first John.
Okay, the other John from Des Moines. Go ahead.
Well, I think people are sick and tired of socialism for the rich and free enterprise for the poor.
Yes.
That's what I think. We see all these billions, hundreds of billions of dollars going to bail out these jokers on Wall Street and the automakers. Let's not forget our antiquated automakers in Detroit that aren't responsive to the needs of the people. And that goes for the politicians. Now, I can't speak for the voters in mass, okay? But I can speak for me as a voter and somebody that supported Barack Obama, worked hard to get his message out and across to family and friends, and now I feel betrayed. We need to start, or Barack Obama needs to know what side his bread is buttered on and who put him in office, and as far as being a left-winger or a socialist, he definitely is not. from my perspective, okay?
Now, but, John, I get where you're coming from, and thank you for your call. I want to see if we can get Steph and Arnie to comment on this, because I think that the Johns from Des Moines that we've heard from, it's interesting that we've got one that is pretty far right that says the problem is the extreme leftist, in his words, leftist agenda of the current administration. Then we've got John, the other John who's on the left, who said, no, the problem is that Barack Obama is going too far to the right. Is the president in a no-win situation? Start with you, Arnie.
I think the president is in a win situation if he chooses to lead. And again, I'm going to repeat what I think is the problem. The problem is you are able to create fictions and fairy tales about Barack Obama if you see no results. The problem with health care reform is it should have been passed in April, not waiting for one vote in Massachusetts in January of 2010. I think the problem is that when you have nothing, you can create any image you want, you can distort any image you want, and depending upon the lens that you have on your glasses, you can see Barack Obama as the evil capitalist, or you can see Barack Obama as the communist. And that is part of the problem. And to some extent, what is really confusing for me, for my conservative John, is that what happened on Wall Street was basically started by George Bush. It was just aided and abetted by Barack Obama. And one would assume that that is something that has conservative capitalist values. And yet the reality is nobody likes it because it unfairly propped up people that failed and then asked for a handout. We resent it when it's a welfare woman and suddenly we write bigger checks because it's a banker. I'm confused.
Stefan, what do you think?
Well, I think this is the dilemma that, Obama faces, which is that he is surrounded by Wall Street bankers and brokers and people who have very special interests and direct connections to failed firms that engaged in very risky behavior. And he is not independent. I think Barack Obama probably leans more towards a socialist perspective if he thought that would work and had people who could make a case for it. I think he really did want, if he could have it, if you could ask him over a beer, you know, that's the Obama way of doing things. You invite somebody over
but that blew up in his face. The whole beer summit was one of the things that people point to as a symptom of the failed first year, or at least his critics do.
But it really isn't. You know, I mean, you sit down with people and you discuss something. How can that ever be a failure? You know, you want to talk to people. You want to bring people together and say, quit fighting. Let's fix this. But Obama doesn't know how to spin that. The Democrats have done a terrible job. And what Obama would tell you if you could have a beer with him is, yes, I would have preferred a national health care system, like the Canadian system or like the German system or others, in which you cover everybody. You have a lot of it actually private insurance in the case of Germany, but public policy makes it possible for everybody to be covered. And you manage it, you ration it, you don't let people have everything they want because it's got to go around so everybody can have it. But that won't work in the United States because the interests are so powerful that you can't do it. So what Obama has had to do, because that's the reality he faces, is he has had to diminish everything so that he is compromising on almost everything, and that's the reality of politics.
Let me go back to something I said. When I was you brought up California, so a pox on you, Stefan, for having brought it up. But by bringing up California, you really do have to talk about something, and that is in the state of California, it requires 2/3 vote to pass a budget or to raise a tax. In the United States Senate, it takes 60 votes to get anything done. Ironically, Scott Brown was the 41st vote. Where in the world the 18 votes have no meaning and no power in the United States Senate? Because the Democrats, technically on paper, have 18 more votes than the Republicans, and yet they are basically castrated and incapable of leading. The American people did not vote for supermajorities, but they're now being harmed by the requirement of that, whether it's in California that can't come to any kind of conclusion on anything and will drift off into the Pacific Ocean, as far as I know, by the time they're done, or what's happening in Congress.
I understand the concern about the gridlock that it may create. On the other hand, though, isn't there something to be said for a political system that does force compromise so that one party or one ideology, regardless of which one it is in power at the time, can run roughshod over the system? Isn't there something to be said for having a 51-49 situation where if something does get done, it has to be the process of the product of compromise? Stefan?
Well, but, you know, the reality is the Democrats really don't have an actual working majority in the Senate because the Democrats are actually 60 individuals. They are not a party. And each individual has their own little, axe to grind, whether it is voting in order to have your state not have to pay for any of the health care in the case of Nebraska, or whether it's something else. Every one of those people is a freelancer who is negotiating on behalf of himself, the special interests that he represents, which is the case of some of the senators from Connecticut.
Actually, they don't have it, Arnie.
The Democrats have to patch together a coalition of cats that don't want to be herded, which is why this has taken so long. It's not because of the Republicans. It's because the Democrats can't agree on things themselves, and that's why they keep going on and on and on. That's why they can't vote, for example, next week and pass this thing, bad as it may be or whatever.
Actually, the sad thing is that you probably could find 50 or 51 Democratic votes that could come to consensus. There might be 15 or 16 of the Democrats, the blue dog Democrats, who are frightened of their base or concerned about the access to money that came in because that's how they won their campaign. But when it came to a simple majority, you have a majority to pass the change. The problem is we don't have the capacity unless you want to take, you know, one of the if you want, unless you want to change the system, which the Senate is capable of doing but has chosen not to do. So again, I want to remind you that is it that you are creating consensus or compromise, Greg, or are parties and the country being held hostage? Does it make sense that this one vote in Massachusetts should change the course of history, which really has been monumental on health care, and not pass this bill? I think not. And sadly, 65% of Americans, when polled in the late spring, early summer, wanted a public option. When did they change? When they were told that there was no public option, that we were aiding and abetting insurance companies, and that they would have to pay more and they would lose on their Medicare. By the time the bill came through, what they thought they wanted had disappeared because it had disappeared.
Let's go to Carol from Carol, who's on the line. Carol from Carol, you're on Talk of Iowa.
Yes, good morning. Hi, Stefan. Hi, Arnie.
Hi, Carol.
From our little part of the ice cube here. I'm going to say again, I hear you now. I'm not going to jump on the let's bash Barack Obama bandwagon because I'm still on the let's bash the people who were bashing Hillary Clinton when she was running against him. Trust me, if she and Elizabeth Warren and Laura Tyson and Warren Buffett had been running the financial whatever it was a year ago, they would not have been playing kissy face with Wall Street.
Carol, I really appreciate the perspective, and I wanted to use that as a jumping off point. Stefan, Arnie, is the situation right now, how much of it do we lay at the feet of Barack Obama? How much of it would have been different if Hillary Clinton had won, or if John McCain had won, or if Mitt Romney had won? How much of this is the responsibility for President Obama, and how much of it was for a whole cadre of things that got us to the point we are right now?
I will lay a significant amount at the feet of Barack Obama. Absolutely. I know his instincts are, Stefan, to have a beer and talk, but it turns out that also exposes his lack of experience with the sharks in Washington, because they don't want to do kumbaya. They don't necessarily want to do good policy. They want to win based on their agenda or based on the clientele they are serving, which is not always the American people, but relatively often special interests. And I think instead of understanding that and using the real bully pulpit he had and using the real political cachet he had at the very beginning to force things through and to act in a leadership capacity, he basically walked away. He was missing in action. He was afraid of what happened with Hillary Clinton when she tried to force feed her solution. So he went 180 degrees the opposite, and that was the wrong choice as well. It is Barack Obama's fault.
Stefan?
Well, I think the system contributes a great deal to this, because I am not convinced that there is anyone in this country who could get elected president who could have managed us through this. Health care in this country is a monstrous, gigantic piece of American life and the American economy. It is complex as anything you can ever imagine.
I agree.
And there is no one who understands it. It's worse than the tax laws of this country, which nobody understands either. And so I think to take that on, and then to take on every other issue that Obama took on, frightened people, because we were doing 10 different things. And at the beginning, I thought it was a good idea. You know, you got to take on making friends with other countries. You got to take on the problem of Guantanamo, the war in Iraq, the economy, education in this country, immigration reform, global warming and climate change. I mean, give me a break. The American people are exhausted. They are just collapsed and dripping with exhaustion from seeing this enormous number of things happening. And health care is the biggest of them, and it's the one that affects every single American immediately and very closely and financially, and therefore it's the most frightening one. And I think to some extent it's admirable that he tried to wrestle it, but it might have been better if over the next 4 years he had each year introduced little pieces of incremental legislation that would improve some of the deficiencies, that would provide more people with health care, that would work with insurance companies, with public facilities, with charities and others to expand health care, to control costs, not a total do-over, which just scared the heck out of everybody.
A couple of people who have some comments here, I'll summarize here and try to get to a point, but Cheryl in Ames and Sharon in Johnston both are saying that the real issue here is special interest groups, not necessarily either one of the parties or any one particular person. They believe that the real issue here is that special interest groups are taking over the country. Stefan Arney, do you agree with that? And if so, is there anything we can do about it?
Yes, of course. Campaign finance reform, which is almost impossible to get. Everybody in Washington is basically dependent on interests that funnel enormous amounts of money to their campaign. And one of the reasons why the election in Massachusetts was interesting is because Coakley had a lot more money and the opponent didn't. So maybe we're seeing some changes here where some folks with smaller budgets can break through with free media and make the case that I am not the agent of, the big money that was shoveled at me.
Well, can I recommend a book?
Campaign finance reform is a good way to start.
But can I recommend a book which frightens me to death, but unfortunately every time I read it I keep going, oh my God. The book is called The Shadow Elite, How the World's New Power Brokers Undermine Democracy, Government, and the Free Marketplace. She's a public policy scholar. She's an anthropologist, Janine Weddle. And the book is it's so scary, because part of the problem is, Stefan, is that now we are dealing with corporations that have no allegiance to place or country.
Right.
They don't have an allegiance. So there is no such thing as a U.S. corporation or as a sense of responsibility to us. Because the responsibility is to the profit margin, to the stockholder, to senior management, but it's not to a country. So, and now with the kind of money that's been flowing into politics, and with the possibility that the Supreme Court may overturn, the McCain-Feingold bill, we're going to see gushers of money when there is so much special interest on the line. And the special interest isn't just about how the insurance companies are going to be successful, but when you look at how we propped up some of the banks, someone said to me the other day, well, they have to give the Goldman Sachs senior management these incredible bonuses. After all, those bankers will leave. And my point is, goodbye. What did you do when you were there but ask us to bail you out? As if that's a threat. But yet it is a threat. So, again, I think we have to look at the money, and we have to look at the fact that there is no sense of borders when it comes to a lot of these special interests. They are porous. They are
poor. And you mentioned it, which is the fact that if you come down too hard on a corporation and squeeze them too hard, they don't have nationalist loyalty. They're not U.S. Sometimes they're not even, you know, U.S. citizens. So they'll move it to London. They'll move it to Dubai. They'll move the whole outfit somewhere else. And there isn't any money, really. There are just digits. And you can set up your computer systems and have your traders and others be almost anywhere in the world with those computers, because it's now a different world. So globalization has really created a problem. And I used to really laugh at the whole notion of the Trilateral Commission, you know, being a conspiracy and so on. I'm a believer now. The Trilateral Commission, you know, which was all the bankers and other big moguls who would get together periodically in some warm place and drink expensive wine and kind of scheme and plan how they were going to make more billions, it doesn't seem so far-fetched anymore.
Let's go to the phones. Michelle in Olwine is on the line. Michelle, welcome to Talk of Iowa.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I was wondering, if the Republicans did get back into leadership, what do they feel would happen? And how can a president just come in a year's time and change all these different things? You know, American people expect everything to be changed in a year's time. Is that being fair?
No, you're so right. You're so right, because taking a look at the Scott Brown election in Massachusetts, what did Scott Brown run on? No health care reform, no ballot. I mean, he didn't run on what he was going to do to fix health care. He didn't run on what he was going to do to fix the economy. He didn't run on what he was going to do to get you a mortgage that was affordable. He didn't run on any of that crap. He ran on no. And unfortunately, no does not solve anything that you are concerned about. And you're absolutely right about Barack Obama. A year is not enough time to dig us out of the hole, not just of the last 8 years, but probably of the last, you know, 28 years that we have been creating. It has been a long, slow process to grow the hole we are in. You cannot possibly fill it in a year. I think the problem is that to some extent perception is reality. And the perception right now in Washington is on his signature issues, he has not been effective.
But Arnie,
and he laid those out, and the problem becomes because he didn't get them accomplished, we don't have a perception that he really is succeeding in moving the ball forward.
But I can also say that a year is more than enough time to scare the heck out of a lot of people.
Oh, yeah.
And
right.
I think what's happened is in the way that he's run things, he's scared the heck out of people. The other thing is he doesn't seem to be connected. You know, I said in my op-ed piece in InsiderIowa.com, which you can go read, that, you know, Obama seems like he's running a seminar at Harvard on some obscure law case. When he gives his press conferences, they are too brainy, they are not passionate, he hasn't gone out and tried to sell something, anything really around the country. He goes on these little excursions, and they're all on different issues. There isn't a coherent theme. He hasn't sent out his cabinet to make the case. They think they can do all of this from Washington the way all, you know, misguided policy wonks think that, you know, they've got the right answer. They're the smartest people in the country. The best and the brightest is what we called them when they were in the Kennedy administration. And that the rest of the country is going to see the light if they sit there and confect these things. And that is not true. All of this has to be sold to people, and you have to give people the confidence and the understanding of what it is you're doing and that it's not scary, and they haven't done any of that. So that, I think, is really, really going to go down in history as having been a style thing. But, you know, Obama was always that way. He was the guy who always voted present when he was in the legislature in Illinois if he didn't really know what to vote for. So he is not necessarily someone who can make a hard decision and stick with it. He is a compromiser. He wants to think about things and fetch about it. And what that has done is send out a perception of confusion.
We have less than a minute on the show. I'd like to ask both of you to give President Obama a letter grade for his first year in office, and what letter grade, kind of like a midterm, what grade you think he can still get by the end of his term. Start with Arnie.
Can I give him an incomplete? All right. I'm such a good professor.
You are a great professor.
And that really is the grade. He's not worthy of a grade.
Do you think
a grade assumes a project has been accomplished? Incomplete is what
I'll
he gets.
I'll give him a C+.
There you go.
A what plus?
He gets a C+ from me.
A C is in cat.
That's right.
All right. Stephen Schmidt.
Or clutch.
I was trying to pick the most neutral C word I could
think
of.
Bye-bye,
Stephen Schmidt, Arnie Arneson, thank you very much for your time. That's all the time we have for Talk of Iowa today. Our program was produced by Dennis Reese, assistance from Christina Sarnelli and Sarah McCammon. Podcasting and on-demand audio of Talk of Iowa is available at iowapublicradio.org. Our theme was composed and performed by Dan Knight. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Jonathan Aull, sitting in for Greg Shanley today. Thanks for joining us.